Well, I hope you're having a fun early Halloween weekend. It's not really Halloween until this Wednesday, so it's kind of an early Halloween. But it's for a lot of people, they won't be celebrating it on Tuesday or Wednesday, just answering the door, I hope, on Wednesday night and handing out candy and staying off the streets if you're going to parties, or stay off the trains once you hear the story of the man from the train. Discovering America's most elusive serial killer, Bill James continues the story next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Bill James works for the, he advises the Boston Red Sox. And so it is that he spends a lot of his time in the sports world. And he was just talking before the top of the hour about the difference between being in that sort of positive place with very positive energy around people involved doing positive community things. And writing the man from the train, because he likes to write about crime. So, do you want to finish that?
You're fading out at the end. I was not able to hear a lot of that.
Oh, I'm fading out. No, can't have that. I was just saying that you were presenting the sort of a dichotomy of working in the sports world by day and writing crime at night.
Yeah, I was saying that crime stories are fascinating to us because they come from the parts of ourselves that we don't like to talk about and don't normally talk about. In the specific case of the man from the train, I didn't make a deliberate and thoughtful entry into the subject. I just got hooked like a fish. I saw a documentary about the murders in Villisca, Iowa, called Villisca: Living with a Mystery. It's an extremely well done documentary and far above the normal levels of crime documentary. I was interested in it, and it was clear that there was a part of the story that was missing, which is that it's relatively obvious that the Villisca murders are a part of a series. So I was just going to put an hour into trying to learn more about the series, but the hour became a week, and the week eventually became 5 or 6 years. I didn't decide to get into it. I just wandered into it.
Yeah, it shows you. Right. Do you consider this a true crime book?
Sure. Yes, it is.
Yeah. You know, and that's the interesting piece, too, is that true crime, you know, the tradition for true crime, as I discovered in my research, goes all the way back to execution sermons, right? Sort of shares a similar DNA with American journalism. Except that in the case of true crime, you know, it was the preachers, it was the circuit riding preachers, the ministers that would come to these towns on the day of somebody's execution, and they would do a sermon just before the execution that would try to provide the context for why this person was being executed and why the community overall would benefit from his or her death. And it became an important part of trying to understand executions in America. And this is where, when the preachers decided they used to just print up their sermons and people would snap them up. And then he thought, well, heck this, I'll just sell it for a nickel. And so they started to sell their execution sermons, and then they would get passed around. And these became some of the early best-selling true crime narratives. It fulfills the same function as what you're doing in The Man from the Train. You're trying to bring in, even though it's 100+ years later, in some cases, you're trying to bring a kind of healing. Anyway, not that anybody's still alive that was directly involved, but for these communities, maybe this lingering sense of some tragedy that had happened, maybe some closure on exactly what happened to their town and how their town was involved or not involved in the deaths of somebody that at one point, you know, were popular members of the community.
There was an interesting thing that happened just a few weeks ago. I actually got a letter from a man in London, England, who was his great great aunt was one of the victims in the crime.
Interesting.
And he had always believed that the man who was accused of her murder and was locked up without any evidence for 2 years before he was released, he had always believed that he had gotten away with it. And he said that reading it in my book, that in our book, that it wasn't, that was not actually what had happened, was just a tremendous relief to him.
Yeah.
And that was a shock to me. I hadn't thought about that happening.
Yeah.
But it was a shock. He said he was just tremendously relieved to realize that it was just a random crime, and that this man hadn't actually, that man hadn't actually gotten away with it. It was this other fellow. And I don't know why it was important to him to, well, I understand in a sense it was important to him to know what had happened. But, you know, one guy getting away with it or another guy getting away with it unpunished, I don't know that there's a lot of difference, but he still did have that reaction to it.
Yeah, I think
the book is, go ahead.
No, please. No, a lot of the book.
A lot of what the book is about is all good books are a search for understanding.
Right.
And a lot of the book is trying to get people to understand the America in which these crimes occurred. They occurred 100 years ago, and I grew up in a small town, very much like the crimes that these murders occurred in, and I grew up in them 50, 60 years ago. So it's sort of equidistant from me and them. And that's one reason that the story was powerful to me. But I'm trying to get people to understand what the criminal justice system was like, how fantastically primitive it was,
right.
How people lived, that they lived rich, meaningful lives. People in urban areas today think of people who lived in small towns 100 years ago, or often think of people who lived in small towns 100 years ago as living these boring lives in which nothing ever happened. All of the things that happened to you and me and people in our lives happened to people in small towns. I mean, they got married, they fell in love and got married, and they got divorced, and they started careers and got promoted and got fired, and they moved and they went on long trips and brought back souvenirs. They had entertainments that they went to literally every night. All of the things that happened to us happened to them. And I was trying to create a picture. Unfortunately, it is a picture of their deaths, and that's a terrible picture because they died terrible deaths. But also I was trying to create a picture of how they lived and give the reader an understanding of what it was like to be an American in a small town 100 years ago.
I think you did that very effectively. In fact, I think that's one of the interesting things about true crime in general, is that the focus can be on things which reinvert the inverted pyramid of journalism. And you can spend a lot more time on the things which are less important to telling the story in proper journalism. You can spend a lot more time talking about the atmosphere of a town, or the things that people ate, or the way that houses were constructed or communities were laid out. You can do that, and it brings a fresh context to these murders, you know, as opposed to the traditional way that crimes are covered in straight storytelling in a journalism context. That's right. What I really like about what you were doing, especially when you were getting into the fabric of these communities.
And there's one incident that always sticks with me that illustrates the point you were just making, and that has to do with the case of Sacco and Vanzetti.
Yeah.
One of them, I think it was Sacco, had an alibi for the time of one of the crimes. One of the crimes was committed on December 24th of, I think, 1919 or 1918. And he had witnesses who said that on that particular date, he was delivering to his neighbors in an Italian community pickled eels, because pickled eels were a delicacy that were eaten on Christmas Day, and there was conflicting testimony that said no, that couldn't have been done on December 24th, because you never buy the pickled eels on Christmas Eve. You have to buy them on December 22nd or something, so that you have time to prepare them and put them on ice for a couple of days before you eat them. it's a tiny detail that you would
right.
that would never survive. I mean, you would never know that that was true of Italian of the way that Italian American communities lived 100 years ago, except that it's important in a crime story. And that's what crime stories are. They're these little. There's a flash of light that illuminates the details of something that would otherwise be totally forgotten.
Yeah, and I think that brings us very effectively to Villisca, Iowa, and the crime story, which, as you pointed out earlier, is the one that starts to give away. The communities are already catching on at this point to the fact that there's a killer on the railways. Take us through what happened in Villisca.
On the night of June 9, 1912, the lights were out in Villisca due to a dispute between the Villisca City Council and the power company. So they had city lights and street lights, but they were out, and the town was in complete darkness. It was a Sunday night. There was a church service, a Sunday night church service organized by one of the victims, by the woman who was the head of the house. After the service, I didn't get into this in the book, but I think it's true. I don't believe the Villisca murders would ever have happened when they did. Had the lights been on. And the reason that was true is that he had committed another atrocity just 6 days earlier, about 100 miles away. And he normally would not have had another outrage that quickly. But because the city was plunged into darkness, it was a perfect opportunity for him, and he couldn't pass it up. Anyway, the two little girls named Ina and Lena Stillinger went home with the Moore family, the family of Henry Moore. They walked home after the church service, and the little girl spent the night with their friend. The little girl was a member of the family. On the morning of June 10, no one is stirring around in the house. His brother finally comes and breaks into the house, finds a couple of bodies and runs out of the house screaming. They bring the town marshal, and his name is Hank Horton. Mr. Horton courageously goes through the house. You have to understand, he has no reason to believe anything other than that a crazed murderer is hiding somewhere in this house. And it's a dark house. He's holding matches in front of him with no gun, to no form of protection. Holding matches in front of himself, going from room to room, finding bodies. There are eight dead bodies in the house, and inside a log house in a small, quiet Midwestern town. And all of them hit in the head with an axe. The axe is found, as it usually is, next to the body of a little girl. The man from the train was a pervert, and he was interested in little girls. And the little girl was usually found in an attitude suggesting that she had been outraged after death. In any case, the crime was not. There was a great uproar, as you can imagine, but the crime was not solved. 2 years later, a con man named J.N. Wilkerson came to Villisca and realized that he could sustain a phony investigation of the crime by keeping people angry. He could keep donations coming in by keeping people angry, and he did that by accusing a very prominent local citizen, Frank Jones, of financing the crimes. There isn't any chance in the world that Frank Jones was guilty or that he had any connection to it. But this campaign to prosecute Frank Jones divided Villisca in a horrible and unprecedented way. The city fought over whether or not Jones did it or didn't do it for several years, and it became a badly divided community. You know, families on one side of the line wouldn't play with families on the other side of the line. They wouldn't go to, they wouldn't shop at their stores. They wouldn't have anything to do with them. This battle lasted in Villisca for, even though Wilkerson was eventually run out of town in 1917, the battle went on for a long time, and the hard feelings emanating from it persisted in the city. I would say to an extent that they persist to the present day.
You know, you mentioned that piece about the person whipping up sentiment and making a false accusation to profit from it. And even that creates a pattern for all too often how crime stories, unsolved crime stories, are treated. Yet, at the same time, it speaks to the fact that there weren't cold case police officers working the crime still. The crimes at that time might have been solved after that period of time, by somebody writing a letter confessing, or somebody knowing somebody but it wasn't, it would have to almost literally like fall in their lap, which again comes back to the power of storytelling and how, by telling a story, the beginning, middle, and end of these events, it doesn't matter how old the story is that it will get people to listen again and to reconsider again, and most likely to connect again to that sense of outrage about what had happened. And so, you know, a static police report won't necessarily, you know, anger people. But when you start telling the story again, people start feeling like, yeah, that's right. But it also keeps kind of the idea of the murder alive. It gives you a sensation again. It that is, you know, the core of sensationalism, but it does. It sort of make you feel it again, the fact that this crime had happened. Had they built a, you know, any kind of memorial to the family? What had the town done to try to come to grips with the fact that this murder had happened prior to even this con man coming to town or afterward?
I don't know that there was that kind of sentiment. I don't know that anyone built a memorial to them. For many years, the Villisca authorities, and I would say this is still true today, that the Chamber of Commerce types in Villisca wish that Villisca was known for something else.
Right.
The house where the crime occurred is still standing and is operated as a kind of blood tourism. It shows up on paranormal TV shows, and people pay to take tours of the house. But if you drive around Villisca, there's no sign anywhere that says where the house is, or, you know, there'll be a sign saying where the doctor's house is, but what Villisca is known for is not mentioned anywhere. That's not an appropriate, it goes without saying that that's not an appropriate memorial, right? I don't know that, you raise an interesting question. I don't know that in any of these cases there was a proper memorial to the victims. Hmm. The victims were mostly poor people. Mostly people the Moore family was very well liked. They were, and the community thought well of them, and the vigorous efforts to solve the crime were a kind of memorial to them. But I don't think there was any physical memorial to them.
You know, sometimes it's just a place where somebody always brings flowers. You know,
right.
Or there's an effort to try to. So it doesn't even have to be like a statue. But it is interesting how communities will sometimes do that, because that is their way of honoring. So, but I think you mentioned the economics piece, and that explains everything. You know, that's one of the reasons why it's usually prominent citizens that enjoy that kind of status, not
but
others.
You know, one of the Manson Train's crimes was the double murder in Colorado Springs. He murdered two families in one night in adjoining houses. But if you go to that community where that happened now, the people in that area still remember it. It's still, they could tell, that's that house right there. It has not forgotten. Many places where these crimes occurred, it was so long ago that it's totally and absolutely forgotten. But in some of them, it's still quite well remembered.
So I want to, you know, I'm going to make a sacrifice here because I was really hoping to finish the book before the interview. But I really want to get to the part about how you think you have narrowed down this suspect. So let's go through that. Let's go through that process. 90 victims starting in the late 19th century, going up to the early 20th century of one man, the man on the train. Does he have a name? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. I think it's been 6 to 8 weeks since the last one. Aren't we due for a new remake of The Mummy? I think it was. Watched that Tom Cruise Mummy the other day. Oh, my God. That was so terrible. It made the last few reboots seem like Orson Welles. I mean, it was just, I couldn't believe it. But, you know, that's the nature of those universal monsters, you know, like the Mummy or Frankenstein or any of this. We have to have them. They're part of our culture. And so we with every new generation, we got to retell them again. And it's just the way it is. Same thing with true crime. It's a way of understanding communities. Sometimes the best way for us to understand ourselves, the living, is to look at the stories of the dead. And that's what Bill James did in The Man from the Train. And he took a synoptic view, this giant look from 30,000 feet at a series of crimes, 90 murders that happened, and started to see the patterns and went back to the earliest one, and we'll find out what he found out about the name of the man from the train next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Bill James, the co-author of The Man from the Train, did the research with his daughter, Rachel McCarthy James. And by the way, when I read more carefully on the back cover, it does say that she lives with her husband, not you. And so, sorry, I got that wrong. But you should be very proud of the work that you all did together. Not every father-daughter team can do that kind of thing. You looked at these murders, and you put them in these different buckets. You know, the percentage that you believed were clearly done by the man from the train, and then well, there's others that might be likely that he did, but you couldn't prove it. Or ones that are very unlikely, but they shared some characteristics, which should also really inform us as to how many unsolved murders were going on back then. We think that's some sort of modern phenomenon, but it certainly isn't, right?
Right. Well, the murder of an entire family in one event is a rare event. It was then and it is now. But there were many, many unsolved murders in that era.
Yeah, I mean, just even as you mentioned, there just weren't any investigative bodies. And if they had one, the investigation wouldn't last for long because there wasn't a lot of funding. But so let's go down this path of the process that you use to try to actually, you know, narrow down to a name, to a person. I've seen this done a couple of times, right? There's been some very interesting attempts to name names with regard to Jack the Ripper, for example.
Right.
And including going through ships' registries and finding whether or not there was a particular sailor that coincided with the murders in Whitechapel and or other parts of the world that shared similar characteristics as the crimes in England, but happened in Central America or happened in wherever. And so they were able to try to find, you know, well, this sailor went from this port to that port, and in each one of these ports there was a murder. So you almost have to start. I mean, it's not quite a needle in a haystack, but it's at least maybe to look at it broadly. You don't even know yet what you don't know when you start doing a search like this. So you don't, you know, is it even possible that a name could even be found, given the scarcity of information about, you know, people or public registries during that period?
You mentioned the Jack the Ripper case. I have read probably 20 books saying Jack the Ripper was this guy or Jack the Ripper was that guy or Jack the, and I in my other book, Popular Crime, I made fun of the people who wrote those books, because I don't have much confidence that you can actually do that. And to be frank, almost all of the arguments that Jack the Ripper is this guy or that guy, almost all of them are silly. I never really expected that we would find a convincing argument about who was doing this. We were looking, yes, and Rachel says that she did expect to find him, but I didn't. But when we walk the crimes backward, there's a crime in Massachusetts in 1898 that Rachel says the moment she saw it, she knew it was him. And that was because I had told her that this guy would make mistakes, and in his first crime, he did make numerous mistakes that let everybody know who he was. But the number of details that match up from the first crime to, let's say, Villisca is just, it's beyond anything that you would suspect could be coincidence. And I'll mention just a few things.
Yeah, please do.
Did you want me to give you the name or not? It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, no, we will, but let's not yet. Go through the coincidence or go through the similarities first.
Well, the first crimes that were sort of publicly linked were crimes in the Portland area. And two crimes in the Portland area were committed rather obviously by the same man. And the same detectives happened to be investigating them and thought, this is the same guy who committed that crime a month ago down South Portland. That criminal had size 6 feet. There's another crime in Maine in 1902 in which the criminals, in which there were a pair of boot prints that were central to the trial, again, size 6 feet. This is very, so we know that this is a small man. Well, it is recorded about the man that we found that he did in fact have size 6 feet, not speculation. He did. We know that it was believed that he was small because, in Villisca and in other places, when he swung the axe, the ceiling was very low. The ceiling is only about 7 feet high in the room where the murders were committed. But when he swung the axe over his head, he just barely grazed the ceiling. If a person of normal size, a large man could not swing an axe over his head in that room without sticking it in the ceiling. Because of that, it was believed that he had to be small. He was 5'4". It was suspected, if you look at the blood pattern, the way the blood flies off the axe, you can see clearly whether the guy is basically left-handed or basically right-handed. That's a pretty easy thing to see. It was believed that the murderer in Villisca was left-handed. The man who committed the crime in 1898 was left-handed. We had said that he had to be, the first stories about him say that he was an experienced tramp, that he would travel around the nation on trains for a while and then he would settle down into an area. We had said that he must work as a logger because all the crimes for about 10 years occur in logging areas. The first stories about him specifically say that he was an experienced logger. The nature of the crime itself, the special attention to a prepubescent girl, that was there in the first crime. In the first crime, he always killed the man of the house first and ended with the murder of a young girl. That's what he did in the first crime. He always used the blunt side of the axe. I can't say he never killed anyone with the sharp side of the axe, but it was always his intention to use the blunt side of the axe. In his first crime, blunt side of the axe. And as he would do in Villisca and many other places, he left the axe on the floor beside the young girl's bed. So the crime just matches up on too many points for you to think that this isn't him.
So as you started to look for a 5'4" left-handed pedophile necrophiliac itinerant logger axe murderer, how did you begin to narrow a name out of that?
When he committed the first crime, it was obvious who had committed it because he was living with the family, which that's a common thing. A serial murderer's first crime, he often kills people to whom he is directly connected and can be tied. So he killed the first family in 1898. Everybody knew that who had done it because he fled the scene and that was who they were looking for. It's just that all of these other facts about the criminal happened to line up with what we were looking for.
And the name that you believe is the man on the train?
The name that he was using there was Paul Miller. He was a German immigrant. Whether that was his actual name or not is speculation. He could have been using a false name even then. However, there's no real reason to believe he was. A friend of mine doing research on his own after the book was published found the ship's record in which he had entered the country about in 1890. Probably a man named Paul Miller had entered the country he walked with a sailor's gait. He was bow-legged and walked side to side. He had been in the German army, German Navy. So they found the ship in which he came into the country.
Is the sailor's gait in reference to lack of nutrition for the bow-leggedness?
No, it's if you're on a ship, you must have taken a cruise sometimes. I mean, you know how the ship rocks from side to side, and when you get off, you rock from side to side for a day or two before you start walking normally.
Oh, interesting.
But
I
if
see
you're
that.
A sailor for years and years, then you never get over it. You always walk from side, rock from side to side.
Interesting. I never knew that. Have you ever heard of something called fractal theory?
The name's a little familiar, but I couldn't tell you what it is.
So there's a math fractal theory, but there's also this other theory about how fractal theory relates to us personally. And psychologically, people will talk about fractals in terms of that we have a tendency to replicate circumstances that are defining experiences in our life because that's how we know ourselves best. So somebody who might have grown up in a very dysfunctional household tends to cleave toward dysfunctional relationships, not go the opposite direction, but they know who they are in a dysfunctional relationship. They know how to act. And so they keep recreating that until they break the habit. So fractal theory often explains whether it's your greatest moment, like you saved somebody from being destroyed in a fire. So you become a fireman so that you can spend the rest of your life replicating your greatest moment kind of a thing. So I wonder what this guy, Paul Miller, was trying to replicate by recreating these circumstances all along the various railways of America.
Well, that's exactly that. There is something odd about him. He was not terribly young. He was believed to be about 35 when the first crime occurred. But I believe that exactly what you just said, that first crime was his secret. It was the most thrilling and the most exciting thing that had ever happened to him, and that he was simply recreating it again and again and again, with more, some variation, but more specificity as he went along. So, the early patterns are not that tight, but the later patterns get closer and closer to the first crime. It's exactly what you're saying, that's who he was. That's how he knew himself. Now, I don't doubt that Mr. Miller had been the victim of terrible abuse as a young person. He was an odd looking man. He had tiny, widely spaced teeth. He was not clean. And I don't doubt that as a consequence of this odd look, that he had suffered terrible abuse, and that the terrible abuse replicated itself in his anger and his outrages. Not that that is in any sense a justification for what he did, but I don't doubt that that was true of him.
Yeah, the pedophilia piece, especially abusing the corpse, if that's what happened, speaks to, you know, the age in which he might have been sort of frozen emotionally, which yeah. makes me wonder whether, and I'm sure you thought of this, could he have been committing similar crimes in Germany, which forced him to go into the Navy, which forced him to, you know, disembark and come to the United States?
Well, I don't know. And you know, there is speculation in the book because a lot of things we don't know about. And you can have no answer. You can have a speculative answer. It's up to you. I would speculate that he had never killed anyone before he killed the Newton family in 1898. I doubt that he'd ever killed anyone before that, because there is an obvious lack of planning and preparation for the event. But I don't doubt that he had committed pieces of the same crime earlier. I very much would suspect that he had inappropriate interactions with young girls, that he had he had a chip on his shoulder. He wasn't like a nice guy in any sense. The documentation of his life around the time of the first crime mentions that he was it wasn't hard to get him into a fight. You know, he carried his anger pretty openly. I don't doubt that there were other violent incidents strewn about his life. But I don't think the whole scenario had come together for him before that.
But still, and that's a great point, what year had he gone into the Navy? Do you know?
We don't know, no.
I'd be curious whether to find the town in which he grew up in.
Yes.
And then check what year he went into the Navy and see whether prior to that year there right. had been something which, you know, he knew he had to get out of Dodge.
Right.
And joining the Navy was a great way to do it. So whether it's just one person who was the victim of his rage, but gave him a great satisfaction. And you know, narcissist sociopaths, which is what this guy sounds like, the most dangerous kind, sociopaths are often rage killers. And they just, you know, it's a pent up thing. And they do it as a kind of release. And I wonder whether that first release came long before he came to the New World.
Well, he was not a narcissist because he was not he didn't have any charm. A narcissist generally is a charming,
right?
Most
True.
Often well spoken,
true.
Clean, makes a good appearance. He didn't do any of that. He was a true psychopath. Psychopaths have no fear. Do not have normal fear. And one thing that's apparent about the man from the train is that he was not acting in fear. He was calm in the middle of events that horrific events that anyone else would have been shaking in their boots. And that was one reason he was able to get by with these for so long. I should have made this other point first. The story of Paul Miller and the Man from the Train is much larger than our book, and we were fortunate enough to find this set of facts about him. But I have no doubt that someone else is going to write another book about him in 10 years or 15 and going to say, well, here's what the Jameses missed. They missed this whole story about Paul Miller in Germany. They missed this whole story mm-hmm. about this crime in Winnetka, Illinois. We don't have any doubt that they're going to do that, and they'll be right. But we had spent years on it, and we had reached the limit of our particular research capacities, so
sure.
we moved on and printed the book. But there is still more story to be discovered there.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Bill James, you ready to take some questions?
Sure, that'd be great.
Okay, so we'll give the phone numbers here coming up in just a second. The Man from the Train, Discovering America's Most Elusive Serial Killer. Or you can ask him about the Boston Red Sox, which he also knows quite a bit about, too. And I may throw in a stray question about the Boston Strangler that's been sticking with me. But we'll do all of that after we give you the numbers for you to join the conversation. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett.